I was just back from a gathering at a interesting place in New Hampshire called the World Fellowship Center, and it was a much older crowd there, and talking to them I realized that talking about biotechnology right now is a lot different than it was even a year or two ago. A year or two ago was an issue that most people really weren't aware of at all. At this point, the strategy of the industry has shifted from trying to keep people in the dark about it to trying to create the sense that it's inevitable, that it's so pervasive, particularly the genetic engineering of food, that it's too late to do anything about it. And I spent a lot of time there making the case for how this technology came to be so dominant in the commercial food industry, and it has a lot to do with the links among the various corporations on the chart that you have, all of whom have roots in the chemical industry. And the extent to which, while that appears to be true right now here in the U.S., for particular crops, basically four, soybeans, corn, canola, and cotton, almost everything else is free of contamination from genetically engineered ingredients or genetically engineered seeds. And in most of the world, agriculture is still free of contamination from genetically engineered crops. So people in most of the world still see this as a technology that needs to be stopped and are taking steps to do so. And if they're not already on the table, I can bring down some of the newsletters that we produce here for a network called Northeast Resistance Against Genetic Engineering that's been trying to coordinate the activities and create communication links among grassroots groups fighting these issues all over this region. The more mainstream framing of biotech issues is very problematic, as I'm sure many of you know. Genetic engineering of food is usually framed in kind of the conventional liberal discourse as a matter of regulatory policy. And since this technology really first emerged in the 1970s, the vast majority of groups working on these issues are groups with a policy focus. They're Washington, D.C.-based NGOs, and they've had the same kind of insidious role in limiting debate on this issue as similar groups have on the whole range of environmental issues that have been framed as questions of regulatory policy rather than as questions requiring a systemic understanding, a systemic critique, and a political approach that really looks at the roots of the problem in the institutions responsible for the problems. The other way the GE food issue is usually framed is in terms of consumer choice, and I'm sure you're all aware of the insidious nature of that. People say things like, if we could only get genetically engineered foods labeled, which of course is the case in now more than 50 countries around the world. People say if we could only get it labeled that it would just go away. And it's, on the one hand, pretty unlikely that that would be sufficient to make it go away, given the concentration of power and the interests at stake. And the other thing is the framing of the issue in terms of consumer choice does nothing to address the environmental problems resulting from growing GE crops, which are addressed in a lot of detail in the book. It does nothing to address the specific threats to farmers posed by increasing corporate consolidation in agriculture. And maybe most importantly, it heightens the class inequities that underlie this issue. because if GE-free food becomes another niche market, the way organic food has become in this country, that's only affordable by a small sector of the population. The mainstream food supply is completely contaminated with GE ingredients. It ultimately worsens the problem and creates a situation where the vast majority of people are eating food that's potentially harmful to our health and very clearly harmful to the environment and to the integrity of agriculture. Speaking of the integrity of agriculture, this is an issue that anarchists have been much more aware of than people in many other radical traditions. Whereas the Marxist left, for the most part, has focused on the industrial working class as the so-called revolutionary subject, anarchist understandings of the roots of social problems and the roots of resistance, of course, have traditionally been much broader. And I thought it would be appropriate to start with a quote from Kropotkin. This is from The Conquest of Bread. He writes, "Bread, it is bread that the revolution needs. Let others spend their time in issuing pompous proclamations, in decorating themselves lavishly with official gold lace, and in talking about political liberty. Be it ours to see from the first day of the revolution to the last, in all the provinces fighting for freedom, that there is not a single man who lacks bread, not a single woman compelled to stand with the weariful crowd outside the bakehouse door, that haply a coarse loaf may be thrown to her in charity, not a single child pining for want of food. The idea of the people will be to provide bread for all, and while middle-class citizens and workmen infested with middle-class ideas admire their own rhetoric in the talking shops, and quote-unquote practical people are engaged in endless discussions on forms of government, we, the so-called utopian dreamers, we shall have to consider the question of daily bread. That we are utopians is well known. So utopian are we that we can go the length of believing that the revolution can and ought to assure shelter, food, and clothes to all. An idea extremely displeasing to middle-class citizens, whatever their party color, for they are quite alive to the fact that it is not easy to keep the upper hand of a people whose hunger is satisfied." Kropotkin, of course, wrote very eloquently in many places about the need for a reconvergence of the urban and the rural, of the theoretical and the practical, of the mental and the physical. And the approach of the anarchist movement going back to the 19th century really speaks to the demand for a reintegration of the whole spectrum of spheres of human activity, and continued to do so through the period when the Marxist left pretty much completely neglected rural issues, agricultural concerns, the basic question of bread, of how we eat. And one of the things that concerns me as somebody who's been working on these issues around biotech and genetic engineering for a long time is that as the movement has become focused on the institutions of global capitalism, and we're having huge mobilizations to confront them, which is an incredibly important and positive and essential thing to be doing, that the left, the movement as a whole, I think in some ways might be slipping back toward the kind of narrow economism where focusing on economic issues and economic institutions is seen as sufficient. It's certainly necessary, but it's not sufficient. And I'd like to speak to a need, and the anarchist tradition gives us a lot of tools to help us do this for holding on to an understanding of a much broader range of concerns, particularly ecological concerns within the radical context. It's interesting that I find for a lot of current activists, people who are becoming newly active around the anti-globalization movement, that ecological issues in particular are something that people take for granted. You know, everybody learns about environmental issues in school now and the framing of environmental issues, food issues, and that whole sphere is something that where people have in some ways a harder time than people did 10 years ago or 15 years ago seeing where the radical content is in that whole realm. And I think as anarchists it's important for us to continue to look holistically at the relationship between environmental and economic concerns, and again to look at things institutionally. The development of technology over the last generation, of course, also speaks to the increasing integration of capitalism in the state. Whether you're looking at the development of computer technology, of course, space technology, rocketry and satellites, telecommunications, any of the technologies that have emerged over the last 50 years, they've emerged to a large extent out of wartime and to a almost total degree of the convergence of interests between capital and the state. And it's equally true of biotechnology. The technologies of genetic manipulation that form the basis of everything from the genetic engineering of food to efforts to genetically engineer and clone human beings. And of course, the other framing of biotech issues that we see in the media a lot right now is the concern about stem cell research, which of course comes from the religious right. And all of the hype, this is an aside which I'd love to get into more later if we have some time, all of the hype around stem cell research, I think, clouds a much wider spectrum of concerns around the potential for and the beginnings of human genetic engineering, turning human reproduction into a commercial process. The whole Brave New World scenario, it's out there. We're seeing a whole revival of eugenic thinking along with that, which the people who are concerned about saving the lives of embryos don't seem to be particularly aware of. Although some of them are. There have actually been some critiques of the new eugenics in the right-wing press, and there's not been anywhere near enough of it in the left press. I was making the point that biotechnology, too, is a product of state funding of research. In the biological sciences over the last 25 years, we've seen a tremendous diversion away from all other ways of looking at biological questions toward a very narrow focus on genetics. And this is true in the plant sciences, it's true in medical research even more so. And this is very much driven by research priorities that are channeled through state institutions like the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation, which fund much of the vast majority of scientific research in universities across the country. And those institutions operate very much in accord with the trends and fashions within science, which are increasingly shaped by capitalist priorities. So I wanted to make that point. Ooh, a critter in my cup of water here. So what analytical tools do various radical traditions offer us for shedding light on concerns about genetic engineering and other biotechnologies? I want to spend a chunk of time looking at what different radical traditions have to offer. And then really spend the bulk of the session addressing whatever questions people have, really about any of the issues around biotechnology and genetic engineering. It's such a huge subject that it's hard to summarize in a short session. So rather than trying to give a broad overview of all the issues, I'd rather just open it up. On the previous point about technologies emerging from warfare, I wanted to make the further point that capitalist agribusiness as we currently know it is itself a product of wartime production. Nitrogen-based fertilizers emerged from the period after World War I when the chemical industry had an excess of nitrate-based compounds that were largely used in the manufacture of explosives. The first generation of pesticides emerged from the period immediately after World War II when the chemical industry had an excess in its storehouses of phosphate-based neurotoxins. And they were the first agricultural pesticides. And the whole shift in focus of the chemical industry toward these kinds of agricultural chemicals is also very much a product of wartime. And of course, through the 1950s and 60s, we saw the increasing proliferation of chemicalized agriculture. Of course, the more pesticides growers have used, the more pesticides they've needed to use because, of course, various insect species are incredibly resilient. They adapt to changes in their environment very quickly. They become resistant to various chemicals. So the amount of pesticides that farmers use to get the same amount of quote-unquote protection is by some measures 10 times what it was a generation ago. And this consolidation of corporate control that the current biotech industry is in many ways the apex of also has a history going back to that same period immediately after World War II. And now we have a small number of companies, between 3 and 5, completely dominating the world's seed industry. And most of those names are listed on the chart. Companies like DuPont that owns Pioneer Hybrid, the world's overwhelmingly largest seed company in the late 90s, Monsanto bought as many major commercial seed companies as it could get its hands on. And some of the mergers of various chemical companies that led to the current so-called gene giants, the 5 or 6 companies that dominate biotechnology. And the same thing's happening, of course, in food distribution with companies like Cargill, Archer Daniels Midland, ConAgra, controlling the distribution of bulk grains. Food retail, increasingly monopolized by the huge supermarket chains, of which there are really only half a dozen left, plus Walmart, which is becoming an increasingly powerful force in the commercial food industry, and also in food production, where, again, a handful of companies monopolize the situation, the largest of which being Nestle. There's been an ongoing battle for second and third place between Unilever and Philip Morris Tobacco, which have been shuffling second and third place in food production back and forth between them and processing over the last few years. So all of these issues speak to the need for a much more systemic and much more radical analysis of issues around food in general, around biotechnology and genetic engineering in particular, than we get from most mainstream or even moderately progressive sources. So where can we go to help us flesh that out? Well, I think the most overarching implication of biotechnology is that it represents the commodification of all of life, the absorption of literally everything that's alive into the sphere of commercial product to be bought and sold and traded in the capitalist marketplace. With biotechnology, we literally see an agenda of redesigning the patterns of non-human nature to better satisfy the needs of the capitalist system. This is something we've never seen before. The discourse around commodification, the idea of the commodity, of course, goes back to Marx, who first pointed out the processes through which the production of the essential necessities of life were being removed from the household sphere, the village sphere, and increasingly into the commercial sphere. So something becomes a commodity for Marx when it becomes externalized, when it becomes, again, removed from the process, the day-to-day process of people working to meet their basic needs, and moves into the sphere of the commercial marketplace. And Marx, of course, focused on the creation of exchange value, supplanting use value. And when things are assigned, when items are assigned a price in the capitalist market, it's on the basis of their exchange value. And exchange values are subjected to all the kinds of manipulations that we see the manipulation of prices based on particularly the power of monopolies and what have you. Through the 20th century, the understanding of commodification grew as more and more activities, more and more spheres of life became absorbed into the commercial marketplace. I think one of the most important pieces that I've learned a lot from on this is the chapter in Horkheimer and Adorno's Dialectic of Enlightenment dealing with the culture industry. They were writing at a time in the 1940s. They were both political refugees from Nazi Germany, came to the United States, actually lived in Southern California for a significant amount of time, so they really saw the beginnings of the culture industry. And it's fascinating now, 50 plus years later, to read what two brilliantly perceptive radical philosophers had to say about the process of culture becoming commodified. And a lot of things that we take for granted around the manipulation of images in popular culture, for them and for everybody at the time, was a brand new phenomenon. And it's really striking to see how that critique of the commodification of culture took shape in that time. As opponents of biotechnology, especially the commercialization of biotechnology, I'm not necessarily opposed to all uses of biotechnology as a research tool, or even of genetic technologies as a research tool, and there are many biotechnologies that don't have the kinds of implications that we talk about in terms of genetic engineering. Biotechnology is a much broader term, where the genetic engineering is the forced artificial insertion of genetic material from one living cell into another, and I can say more later about how that's done. The idea of technologies involving our knowledge of living processes at the cellular and molecular level isn't necessarily a negative thing. And I think in a free society, we would be using our understanding of biological processes to develop ways of doing things, of meeting practical needs that would be working in alignment with rather than against the patterns of nature, using approaches that have emerged from many traditional technologies of the past to the kind of knowledge that's emerged with research in the organic movement and in agriculture and what have you, taking much of our knowledge about the patterns of the natural world and using them in a systematic way. That's not a bad thing by any means. But the technologies that we're focusing on here are fundamentally technologies of manipulation and control. And that's a qualitative difference. In the 1990s, Murray Bookchin, who's one of the founders of our institute here, wrote about the commodification of culture as well, actually beginning in the 1970s and 80s. And of course, by then, the commodification of processes of everyday life had gone qualitatively further than they had in the 1940s. In a 1983 essay, which is republished in the book The Modern Crisis, which we have upstairs, Murray wrote, "From the 1950s onward, the market economy has not only imperialized every aspect of conventional life, it has also dissolved the memory of the alternative life ways that precede it." The idea of commodity culture colonizing more and more spheres of our day-to-day lives and even our private lives is something that has grown to frightening proportions. And Murray proposed a moral economy grounded in community and grounded in face-to-face directly democratic decision-making at the community level as an alternative way of making decisions, both economic and political decisions in society, and still does. I think it's worth pointing out also that beginning in the early 60s, Murray posited the idea that we were living in an increasingly synthetic environment. His first book, which came out the same year as Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, was called Our Synthetic Environment. At that time, in the early 60s, the focus was on chemicalized agriculture, which is something Murray's been writing about since the 1950s, the increasing density of cities, and the increasingly pervasive problems around urban pollution, which people were really just becoming aware of in the early 60s. And he framed that theoretically as a move toward the patterns of nature being replaced by, of non-human nature being replaced by synthetic processes. And of course, biotechnology, as I've pointed out, takes that so much further. Now, as a result of the political influence of the biotech industry, we have the patenting of living things, and this has become a huge issue in many areas of the world where the U.S. using the institutions of the WTO, has tried to impose this agenda of making life forms patentable on countries all over the world. And there have been huge parliamentary debates in countries like India, demonstrations of as many as a million farmers organized against the commodification of seeds. Of course, in traditional agricultural societies, seeds are not a product that's bought and sold in the marketplace. Seeds are something that are passed down from generation to generation. Communities of people do their own breeding and try to develop varieties that are better and better suited to their particular local conditions. And the idea of a seed, of seeds as a commercial product, with the ultimate development of that being the so-called Terminator seed, which is still under development by the biotech industry. These are seeds that produce plants whose seeds are dead, whose seeds are completely sterile. And that's a technology that's still in development, although the commercialization and licensing of Terminator seeds is something that is continuing to develop behind the scenes. And even though it's an issue that has galvanized people around the world as the ultimate symbol of where the genetic engineering of food is heading, the companies responsible for it and the other institutions responsible for it, particularly the U.S. Department of Agriculture, are continuing to rush ahead with it. So we have the patenting of seeds, the patenting of living organisms, the patenting of DNA sequences, including well over 1,000 human DNA sequences that have been patented in the United States. And this has been a big issue internationally too. In the mid-90s, researchers at RAFI, the Rural Advancement Foundation International, discovered that the U.S. National Institutes of Health had taken out patents on genetic sequences from three groups of indigenous people in different corners of the world that had genetic qualities that they thought might potentially be of interest for further research and possibly for the development of new pharmaceuticals. And by the way, this technology, as much as it's driving further monopolization in the food industry, it's also driving accelerated monopolization in the pharmaceutical industry as well. So they found genetic sequences of potential commercial interest in indigenous people from the Solomon Islands and Panama and Papua New Guinea and filed for patents on these three sets of DNA sequences. It caused tremendous outrage from all over the world, and sufficient pressure was brought to bear on the U.S. NIH that they actually renounced those patents. But there are still pharmaceutical and biotech companies traveling the world looking for unique genetic sequences, especially in isolated indigenous populations, because they tend to have more homogeneous genetics than most people. Also, if there are conditions that or particular health problems that they might have a genetic propensity toward, there's no such thing as a gene for a disease, by the way, and I'll get into that. But if there are conditions that they might have a gene, in most cases, 95%+ of cases, if there are qualities that they have a particular genetic propensity for that's of potential research and pharmaceutical interest, these companies are actively going after patents. And there are, as I said, about 1,000 human DNA sequences that have since been patented. One more theoretical current that I want to get to before moving on is looking at the economic origins of the current interest in biotechnology. Of course, for the last 20 years or so, we've been told that new technology is what's driving patterns of investment, is what's creating the potential for new pools of wealth. And in the 1990s, of course, we saw the tremendous growth in the stock market and what have you, based on the growth of the internet and telecommunications and computer software and what have you. And this represents a qualitative change in the way capital is accumulated, in the way fortunes are made in, under global capitalism from a couple of generations ago. Where did this focus on new technology come from? And many writers in various, again, neo-Marxist traditions have tried to look at the shifts in investment and the shifts in economic power that have happened over the last generation. And it turns out that it really all began with a huge crisis of profitability in global capitalism that happened in the early 1970s. Many historical currents converged at that time to create a real crisis of profitability within capitalism. First of all, much of Europe as well as Japan had recovered from the almost complete destruction of their economies that happened during World War II. Secondly, the increasing productivity of industrial capitalism had accelerated to the point where there was almost nowhere else to go for people seeking to make fortunes under the traditional patterns of capitalism. And there was a huge crisis of profitability that struck corporations worldwide. And what this led to was a restructuring of the world's monetary system. It's when when the exchange rates between various currencies stopped being fixed and started floating on the world market, and currency speculation started taking up an increasing share of investment dollars, around the world. And there is also the beginnings of a qualitative shift toward different kinds of production. Let me read a paragraph from a book by David Harvey that really addresses a whole range of issues. It's called The Condition of Postmodernity, and it's one of the better introductions to postmodern thinking from a political perspective. And there's a whole middle section that really focuses on economic and political changes that, in his view, have in many ways underlie the philosophical shifts that we've seen in the last generation. He writes, this is David Harvey, "Flexible accumulation, as I shall tentatively call it, is marked by a direct confrontation with the rigidities of Fordism." Fordism, named after Henry Ford, of course, the founder of mass-scale commercial production, the auto industry being the archetypal example of large-scale industrial production as the organizing principle of a whole sector of society. It rests on this new system, rests on flexibility with respect to labor processes, labor markets, products, and patterns of consumption. It is characterized by the emergence of entirely new sectors of production, new ways of providing financial services, new markets, and above all, greatly intensified rates of commercial, technological, and organizational innovation. It has entrained rapid shifts in the patterning of uneven development, both between sectors and between geographical regions, giving rise, for example, to a vast surge in so-called service sector employment, as well as to entirely new industrial ensembles in hitherto undeveloped regions. And he goes on and on. So there was this shift toward flexible production, toward service economy, toward the so-called information economy. The patterns of investment have shifted. The basic structures of the system haven't changed as much as some mainstream economists like to make it seem. But through that period, we had the beginnings of the fast food industry. Again, the culture industry is an increasingly central part of the system, particularly in terms of the U.S. and its exports, other than agricultural products, which of course are being rejected by more and more countries because, again, most of the world doesn't want our genetically engineered grains, military weapons. The third major export of the U.S. is now commercial culture. And biotechnology plays a role in that. We saw at the end of the 90s the bursting of the high-tech bubble of the 80s and 90s. And capital, again, is in this continual search for new ways of channeling accumulation, new ways of accumulating huge profits. And a lot of venture capitalists, a lot of major investors are really hoping that biotechnology is going to be the next big thing. Of course, it's a lot harder to genetically engineer a food, or even more so to get a new drug on the market, than it is to publish a piece of software or put up a web page. And because of that, the biotech industry has had already, this is an industry that's only existed since the 1980s, had many peaks and troughs in its investment patterns and in its profitability. It's created a huge magnet for investors many times, and the bubble has also already burst many times. So there's something inherently unstable about it. But still, for capitalists kind of desperate to find the next big thing, as industrial production has become increasingly superfluous, really, to the accumulation of large fortunes, the manipulations of finance capital are probably much more dominant, or are much more dominant now in the global picture of capitalism than production. Production has been relegated increasingly to marginal areas, and even for the major transnational companies that have built their empires on conventional industrial production, financial machinations have become a greater and greater portion of even their own businesses. So biotech plays a role in all that. The last piece, of course, and I'm going way over time, I really want to open it up for discussion, is the role of biotechnology in globalization per se. And I've already mentioned the role of the WTO in pushing the agenda of patenting, the rules that allow for the patenting of living organisms are part of the same set of WTO rules that, for example, allow the U.S. to crack down on other countries' supposed permissiveness around copying videos and computer software. They're the rules governing so-called intellectual property, and the WTO provision is known as TRIPS, which is trade-related intellectual property rights. And that whole area is supposed to be up for renegotiation at the WTO meetings in Qatar this fall. And critics of globalization from around the world have focused on biotechnology, particularly genetic engineering as one of the main vehicles of hegemony, of increasing control of the system over other parts of the world. Vandana Shiva's critique of the Green Revolution, which was supposed to bring prosperity and better, improved, higher yielding varieties of basic grains and solve the problems of hunger around the world, has of course exacerbated hunger around the world. And I won't go into a lot of detail on that. I've already mentioned some of the contributions of social ecology. Another one that I want to point out is that social ecology offers a dialectical and much more nuanced understanding of the relationship between technology and society. As social ecologists, we reject the idea that technologies are just tools, that a technology can be, depending on its social context, be used in any way at all, that technology is somehow value-free. So in the 1970s, we had some people on the left saying that socialist nuclear power would be a lot better than capitalist nuclear power. Of course, the Chernobyl accident took care of that argument pretty decisively. social ecology also rejects the idea that technology is in itself an almost autonomous force of social development, that we need to understand technologies in their social matrix, that the form that technological development takes is a direct product of the society that produced it. And then the cycle continues, whereas the development of particular technologies heighten those very qualities of that society. So it's a mutually reinforcing process of technological and social development. That's why we say that the technical applications of biological knowledge in a different society would, in my view, be qualitatively different. The whole research agenda would be qualitatively different from the technologies of manipulation and control that, again, the entire direction of the biological sciences over the last 25 years have brought us. So we have a technology that represents, in many ways, the apex of corporate, of capitalist dominance. Over essential needs, over food, over healthcare, over potentially life in general. We have a technology that's inherently uncertain and fundamentally hazardous. And I haven't gone into all the reasons for that. I'm sure many of you are familiar with those arguments, and they're described in detail in the book. And we have a technology that in many ways helps illuminate the way the system operates. And many issues, in some ways almost any issue you focus on, can do that. As activists, we work with issues of immediate concern as ways of illuminating the workings of the system. And hopefully we develop ways to approach issues systemically and use our day-to-day work as activists to help people understand the system and the need for it to be completely overturned and replaced by something better. In the case of food systems, there's a lot of good thinking happening in many places, including here, about the potential for directly democratic, community-controlled food systems. We don't need for the vast majority of our food to travel 1,500 miles to get to our tables, consuming, according to some figures, 8 times the amount of energy in transporting the food than the energy content of the food itself, and locally controlled food systems subject to the direct control of communities, I think, is the answer to that. I think I'm going to stop there and open it up for discussion.